This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The race for lieutenant governor took a dramatic turn this week when Republican candidate Randy Brock released two radio ads that questioned the character of his Democratic progressive opponent, David Zuckerman. On Tuesday on Vermont Edition, Brock said there are many important issue differences between the two candidates, but none as important as the issue of character. And that's something that Brock says he has, but he says Zuckerman does not.
In my years in public office, I'm proud of my strong record of service to Vermont. My opponent, David Zuckerman, has a record too, and it should concern all of us. The job of lieutenant governor, a heartbeat away from being governor, is too important to elect someone you can't trust.
How does David Zuckerman respond to Brock's allegations, and what are some of Zuckerman's top campaign priorities? These are a few of the topics we'll be discussing today with lieutenant governor candidate David Zuckerman. Great to have you back on the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob. I'm happy to be here.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. For the first time since 2010, Vermont has an open seat for lieutenant governor. What are your thoughts about this race? What are some of the top issues that you would like to see the lieutenant governor focus on over the next 2 years? Strengthening the state economy, perhaps it's health care, tax policies, property tax reform. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So let's talk about some of Randy Brock's charges that he made on this program earlier this week. I don't want to go through them all, but I do want to give you an opportunity to respond to some of the comments he made about what he called your lack of character as a person. So number one, these are Randy Brock's words. You've said that discrimination that minorities experience is like the scrutiny faced by men with long hair. And for some of our listeners who might not have seen you, for as long as I've known you, you've had a ponytail for many, many years. I believe Brock is referring to comments that you made about issues surrounding discrimination on VPR back in July. So what did you say? How do you respond to his comments?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Bob, because it's very frustrating when people take words extraordinarily out of context, twist them, and create a whole new meme. And that's really what my opponent has done with these ads. And I think it's sort of an act of desperation. I've had great support all over the state from folks due to the issues I'm talking about, what I've worked on over 18 years as a legislator. And I think the issues I've been working on have really resonated with Vermonters. And so he's chosen to take this the right-wing playbook, and he's going for it. When you actually look at what I've said, and I've said it a number of times, frankly, was that we all have to look at our own inherent biases about any stereotypes that we have about individuals, where we put them into a group mindset based on a characteristic. And I put out a few different characteristics. However, where he then turned it into was that the discrimination or the ramifications of those stereotypes would be somehow parallel. And I have certainly never made any indication in that regard. It is quite clear, and I've spoken of this regularly, that the challenges that people of color face in our state and across the country, and their statistics coming out daily, just yesterday in the New York Times, a story by a report that was done by the American Civil Liberties Union and Human Rights Watch, talking about that whites are more likely than blacks to use illicit drugs, and they list a range of them, and yet black adults are more than 2.5 times as likely to be arrested. So when we look at the ramifications of either stereotyping or profiling, those discriminations are hugely severe, and there's no comparison. But he's chosen to make there be a comparison, which is just not true.
Let's go to another one of his charges. Quote, he billed the taxpayers for mileage he never drove. What he's referring to is that members of the legislature are given an allowance for mileage, meals, and housing. And at the time that he's referencing, I believe lawmakers signed a form at the beginning of the session to claim certain allowances. You were commuting from Burlington, claimed the mileage allowance. A number of Chittenden County lawmakers, including you, often carpooled to the State House, and all of you claimed the mileage allowance. So is he somewhat right in this regard?
Well, actually, he's not at all. Both the law and the practice, as told for us to do by legislative council, and that legislators, not just from Chittenden County, by the way, all over the state, follow the same rules and practices. All three were allowances. In fact, in the same article that he's chiding me for, he talks about how on the meals allowance, he doesn't spend the whole allowance, but takes the whole allowance. The point is, they're allowances, right or wrong in terms of how the system is set up. That's what the system was. And I participated in the system the same way as everybody else did. You know, ultimately, there were times when I also stayed overnight, and I was supposed to change the form to equate to an overnight allowance. Well, the overnight allowance was greater than the mileage allowance, and I often didn't change it because actually the hassle of doing that all versus the dollar difference. So it went both ways, and ultimately I followed the same practice that he did and everybody else in the legislature.
And that's since been changed, has it?
It actually was changed in part because I went to the news to talk about the challenges of the system, which is sort of what's so ironic about both the story that was published and then now his use of it, again, taking a lot of issues out of context. It actually got changed not even just the next year or a couple of years later. It was changed just a few years ago because now legislators, instead of filling out a form at the beginning of the session indicating how far they live from the state house or how often they're going to stay overnight, legislators now enter their own data each week, and that's verified by the legislative council. And so as the practice changed and as the instructions changed, I have continued to follow the rules.
So if someone was carpooling under the new rules, you would put down that you were carpooling on these specific days and not receiving.
You would put zero because you didn't drive.
Randy Brock also said, quote, Zuckerman has equated the fight for marijuana legislation to the fight against racism. You touched on this just a few moments ago. What is the connection between the two?
Well, the connection between the two is that, frankly, the war on drugs, far beyond just marijuana, has been an incredibly disproportionate judicial attack on people of color in our country. Specifically, when it comes to cannabis, it started back in the 1930s when hemp was a perfectly normal crop to grow. People used it. George Bush had a parachute cord in World War II that was hemp. But what happened was the opponents started equating it as marijuana and equating it to Mexicans and building a racist attack on it because of stereotyping against Mexicans. Then when you look in the 60s and early 70s with the anti-war movement and the civil rights movements, under the Nixon administration, you had incredible disproportionate arrests for drugs against those movements as a political tool by the administration, again, disproportionately affecting people of color. So the equation of the two is that our war on drugs has created yet another situation for people of color where they are disproportionately affected by law enforcement. That's where the connection is. It is not about saying legalizing marijuana is a civil rights issue, which is the way my opponent is characterizing what I've said in terms of the civil rights movement and, you know, getting rights and access to bathrooms and bus service and the tremendous number of discriminatory practices that have happened in the past, but that there are ramifications for people of color with respect to our drug laws, and that is a fact.
Have you ever equated the fight for the legalization of marijuana to the fight against racism?
No, I've equated that there are ramifications to our drug laws that are disproportionate with people of color. But I have not equated the fight for legalization as being on any kind of moral parallel to the fight for civil rights and equal treatment.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Tina, who is calling from Colchester. Hi, Tina. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I want to ask Mr. Zuckerman, he's in favor of legalizing marijuana. I'm all in favor of the medical marijuana. However, I am not in favor of recreation marijuana. The young people and anybody that takes marijuana, I call them potheads, and they're not going to get enough high from marijuana. They'll go to something stronger, and we got enough problems as it is. We don't need any more stronger drugs coming in. So I'm very much against legalizing marijuana for recreation purposes. Medical purposes, fine. I'm all for that, but not recreation purposes. And I want to vote for Mr. Zuckerman, but I'm not in favor of recreation marijuana. Thank
okay.
you very much.
Tina, thanks very much for your phone call. You know, there have been some studies that have come out in the last few months about states where legalization has taken place and increased use of marijuana by young people. Does that give you pause for concern?
Well, what I've learned, at least, well, first let me say thank you, Tina, for calling in, and thank you for recognizing there's a lot of different issues out there. So I appreciate your sentiment of support and expressing difference of opinion. And I think that's healthy in a democracy, and I really appreciate that. There are a number of different studies, and you'd have to cite the ones you're talking about, Bob. But what I've seen from Colorado, which is sort of the hallmark cannabis state that everyone looks at, the actual use amongst teenagers of cannabis over the last 4 years is basically unchanged. It is slightly down, if anything, but it's within the margin of error, so we can call it unchanged. Folks think and have the emotional reaction that it would go up, but it hasn't. And I suspect the issue in Colorado is much more about how's the economy as a whole. And when the economy is good, people do fewer drugs. When the economy is bad, people do more. But for me, the real issue is not about whether using cannabis is a good or bad thing. It's really about access. And when we look at use throughout the state of Vermont, we are actually one of the highest use states for teenagers in the country, close to 70%. So when the question is, are they going to smoke more? I say, you know, we can't go much higher in terms of the rate of use. What we can actually do is make it harder for our teenagers to get it. And Tina referenced somewhat the gateway drug topic by saying they're not going to get very high off marijuana, so they're going to use other drugs. It is statistically very clearly shown, and I think Governor Shumlin deserves a lot of credit, both just talking about the opiate crisis we have, but also statistically, the opiate challenges are coming from prescription drugs that folks have taken to deal with pain and other trauma, then leading to more heroin use, as well as various experimentation. But what I would like to do is actually split the relationship of cannabis and those other drugs. Right now, if you're a teenager, think about it. You're out on the street buying this somewhere from someone. You don't know if it's got herbicides or pesticides, which aren't particularly good for you to smoke. But even worse, you don't know if it's laced with some other drug. You don't know if that drug dealer might be interested in getting you hooked on another drug. So frankly, moving the cannabis market to a regulated environment is probably going to actually reduce that likely connection as opposed to add to it. But I understand that that's sort of a different way of thinking for folks compared to 60 or 70 years of thought process that this leads to that. But really, the statistics bear it out that there's better management of cannabis under a regulated system than there is in an unregulated system. And Bob, I'll just finish with, when you look at alcohol, we decided a long time ago that a regulated system was better. Now, I think hands down, people would be very clear that there are real challenges with alcohol in our society today. But the vast majority of folks consume alcohol in a responsible manner, and then we deal with the ramifications for those who do not. But no one is saying, let's ban alcohol and go to a prohibitive model, because we recognize that that actually leads to more crime, more underground markets, and more criminal activity, and that's not what we want.
Let's talk to Emmett, who is calling from South Londonderry. Hi, Emmett. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you.
What's on your mind today, Emmett?
Well, on my mind today is that David's made many positive changes for our local agricultural economy. His character is certainly solid if he's been able to manage and work with the seasons and as a farmer for over 20 years. I'm also, to be clear, an organic farmer in the state of Vermont and have known David for a long time. And regardless of that, as someone from South Londonderry and the idea that Southern Vermont is forgotten by Montpelier, as David was a representative and a senator, he responded to all my phone calls and emails within 48 hours, even though he was not my representative. And I think that's very positive for all of Vermont. And lastly, I just want to say that when I ran for representative in 2012, the secretary of the and treasurer of my opponent was Republican Oliver Olson. And I think that it's just something that happens in the Republican constituency when they don't know what to say, when they don't have anything on you. It was shocking to hear what Brock said about David, because what was being said about me by Oliver Olson was that he would say, I like Emmett, but he did something I can't forgive him for. And it's such a vague allegation against character that doesn't mean anything. And the reason why I know he said this is because he wrote it on a piece of paper of a local person who is deaf, and that person was a strong supporter of me, and he asked me to come and read it. So this isn't something I'm making up.
Okay.
And I think it's really important to recognize that if there isn't something specific to say about David, it's because there really isn't anything to say about David. And we would be so fortunate to have a progressive representative and senator become a lieutenant governor, because he's been working outside the two-party Democratic control government in Vermont and learned how to work with all the people in Montpelier.
All right, Emmett, I think we've got a pretty good idea where you're coming from. You're a big supporter, and we appreciate your phone call. Let's talk to Elise, who is calling from Essex Junction. Hi, Elise. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you so much. Hello, David.
Hello.
I'm calling today just to say that I did hear the ad from Randy Brock, and I discounted most of it after I went to your website and looked at what you actually, at your response to his accusations. So I am a progressive in the state and a Bernie Sanders supporter. My concern did come in when I read about your vote on the philosophical option for vaccination. I do have a family member who is autistic, and I've been on both sides of the vaccination camp based on the data and the science that's come out. And I have a real concern about this issue, because we can say that it only impacts the parents of the child that they're making the decision for, but it doesn't. It makes an impact on our community, on our children, and for people who medically can't have vaccinations. So I'd really like to hear where you stand on this and how you arrived in that, because I have to say I agree with you on almost everything, but that one's a real hard one for me.
Okay, Elise, thank you very much for your phone call. We've gotten a couple of emails about this as well, David, wondering if you believe the science behind vaccinations. And ultimately, I believe you voted against the bill that removed the philosophical exemption. Is that correct?
Well, actually, there was not a roll call vote on that bill. And I believe in the end I actually voted yes, even though what I voted to do was to change the language to delay the removal of the philosophical exemption. And that was an amendment that I put in to say, let's remove the philosophical exemption when we have a quicker genetic test for predisposition for those folks who actually do have a reaction, an adverse effect reaction. Now, that is a very small percentage of the folks that are out there. It would allow for those individuals, if they have a child who has had a serious adverse reaction, to then look at their second or third children and say, you know, in our genetics, we simply have a reaction. That's going to happen when you have 300 million people to any drug that's out there. It's not specific to vaccines being scientifically problematic. And that I also want to clear up. I do believe in the science of vaccines. I think they are generally very safe across the board. But there are some for whom there's a negative impact. And I guess for me, I have a personal place in my heart for them, just as I do for those, as the caller Elise called in about, with who can't get vaccinated or have autoimmune deficiency challenges, in that my father passed away when I was young, just 13, from a medical advancement that has actually helped hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions, given that we're now talking over 20 years ago, with the new technology at the time, which was to use, I think it was barium in people's blood, so that doctors could see their blood vessels. Well, four doctors passed away of stomach cancer because at that time they hadn't realized that they should wear lead vests and they would be exposed every single operating procedure they did. So as we've learned prophylactic measures to alleviate that consequence, that's a good thing. And, you know, generally as policymakers, the goal is to look with facts, listen to our constituents, understand all the different perspectives on an issue. And I think that's what I've done for 20 years or 18 years of service over the last 20 years, bringing in people from all perspectives, whether it be this issue or many others, to really understand the consequences both for people individually and their lives with whatever the policy is, but also the science on all sides. And then one always has one's personal reflection. And so I did try to delay it, because I wanted to make sure those families were also protected. But in the end, I actually voted for the bill, if I'm not mistaken.
Today on the program, our guest is the Democratic and progressive candidate for Lieutenant Governor, David Zuckerman. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to talk about health care in Vermont. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, the Democrat progressive candidate for Lieutenant Governor, David Zuckerman. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. As we mentioned at the top of the program, there are some big issue differences between you and Randy Brock, and one of them is health care. Randy Brock wants to do away with Vermont Health Connect and bring more competition into the private health insurance market. For some time, you've supported a publicly financed health care system where all Vermonters get coverage. Why is your approach better?
Well, ultimately, you know, when we look at different government policies, we have to look at what is the broad interest of the public and where should and shouldn't government be involved. When you look at insurance rates for large corporations who either self-insure or negotiate good rates with their insurance companies because of scale, they do far better than individuals do on the open market. Better plans at a better price. That's the power of negotiation. So when someone like myself and many others across the state, and Bernie as a great leader on this issue, are advocating for a universal health care system, that's exactly what we're talking about. A, removing all the bureaucratic hassle and nightmares of numerous insurance companies and doctor's offices having staff to deal with collecting reimbursements and numbers from all these different companies. That's a huge cost that isn't actually providing health care. But also then using those dollars more efficiently on health care, paying to have more doctors and more nurse practitioners and more acupuncturists and more alternative medicine providers, all working with people to improve our health and dealing with primary health care as a basic fundamental right. Now, is it a right in the Constitution? No. But is it a moral right in a civilized, economically well-off society as we are here in this country, and even with the challenges we have in Vermont compared to the rest of the world, still relatively well-off? Absolutely. So for me, it's about more efficiency and better health care.
So a couple of years ago, Governor Peter Shumlin looked at this issue and concluded that using a payroll tax would not be a great way to pay for a single payer. It would hurt the Vermont economy. Was his analysis wrong?
Well, I'm not going to challenge his analysis because he probably had a lot more numbers and a lot more research in front of him. I do think it's an issue we have to look at because part of it was the transition costs are part of what make it very expensive and difficult as well. What I'm really excited about is we have a couple different options coming forward for discussion in the coming year from research that's coming out this fall and this winter relating to either universal primary care or Dr. Dinosaur 2.0, which would expand Dr. Dinosaur, which is broadly supported throughout the state, to moving it up to, I think it's about 26 years old, so that we expand that and show that coverage can be simple, can be reasonable, and that people can get the health care they need. So I think, you know, a lot of folks have looked at the huge transition and the difficulties of that and instead said, let's look at this methodically. Let's show that we can do it right, because obviously right now there's a lot of angst about not really doing it right with the Health Connect website, and that's perfectly justified and frustrating for everybody. But by the way, those of us in office as well as everybody around the state.
So what do you say to those folks who say, okay, single payer, it's an interesting concept, but the state has shown putting Vermont Health Connect together has been an enormous challenge.
It has been a disaster.
And if the state can't get that right, how is it ever going to get single payer right? Some listeners may be thinking that.
Sure. Well, actually, single payer is far less complex than Health Connect. In terms of creating this whole system where every year we log in and we put in all this data and then it churns and moves around and you pick which plan and then it spits you back a number and then somehow that number changes because your job changes or the computer database messes up. A true single payer system is straight out of either payroll taxes or income taxes, which we all know how to file and have filed many times before, and you're just in. So there's actually a lot of difference between the two. I don't think single payer is, frankly, a topic of the moment today. I mean, we could talk about it, but that's sort of theoretical in that it's really looking at doing a more pragmatic implementation of one of these two other programs. And I think we've really got to look at the numbers that are going to come out and figure out how to do that. Again, Health Connect has been a disaster. But if you actually look at some of the proposals of my opponent or the candidate for governor on the Republican side, one of them was just quite debunked just the other day on, I think it was Vermont Digger, with respect to the numbers. And that moving to merge with Connecticut, which actually isn't really a feasible plan, and now he's saying he wasn't interested in doing that, even though it was pretty clear he talked about doing that, would actually cost about $5 million more a year in state dollars. And we wouldn't necessarily have the same supports for low-income people. So when my opponent and others talk about moving away from Health Connect because of the boondoggle factor, that's very understandable, and we need to fix that. But moving away from it also means taking away support systems for low-income people working minimum wage jobs that we are now helping afford their health care. You know, all of this comes back to our economy. All of it comes back to people's standard of living. And when we continue to have a low minimum wage, we have to subsidize that through taxes and bureaucracy on support for housing, support for health care, support for education or early childhood education. We pay for it either way. And I think sometimes that gets lost in the rhetorical discussion that happens around private enterprise versus government involvement. You're going to pay for it. And if you go the private route, some of us are going to pay for it. The working class people are going to pay for it a whole lot more than the wealthier folks. And even, you know, going through government is more costly in some regards because you've got to take money in and then dole it back out. If we were to raise the minimum wage, we would actually start to move towards where it's both private sector and straightforward.
Teachers in Burlington have announced that they would go out on strike, I believe, next week if their conditions and negotiations are not successful. There was a bill in the legislature some time ago that would actually prohibit teachers from striking, but tie that to binding arbitration. What are your thoughts on that issue?
Well, I did not support that. In general, I support organizing rights and the various tools that come with that. You know, when you do organize and you work with other people, you often have a stronger voice than as a single person trying to negotiate for yourself. And I think that's an important right to have and one that we shouldn't be compromising. You know, I stood with the teachers last week saying, come back, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, come back to the table and negotiate. You know, the teachers aren't saying, we're going to strike if we don't get what we want. They're saying, we're going to strike under an imposed contract that is not bargained in good faith. Those are two different things. It's very important that you come to the table. You might use arbitration. There's various tools, and it sounds like right now the school board has stepped away from using those tools and is imposing a contract. When one side uses sort of ultimate tools, that kind of forces the other side to do so. I would hope that they both come back to the table and can work this out.
So why wouldn't binding arbitration be a way to deal with this?
Well, I mean, ultimately, negotiations are what they're supposed to be, and they're a give and take. And, you know, they can agree to do binding arbitration as part of negotiations. But to take a tool away from one side without taking it away from the other is unilateral disarmament. And I'm not sure that's right. You know, if you can impose a contract, but the other side can't strike, then you've got, you know, a challenge there. And I don't know that in that law that or that proposal, maybe that was in there. I'd have to learn more. But if it was one-sided, I can't support that.
Let's get a quick call in from Mark in Stowe. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Yes. I'd like to know, the yes or no, under Act 46, will you force high-performing school districts that have lower than the average state cost per student, will you force them to merge into school districts over 750 kids? Is a yes or no answer?
Well, first of all, it's, I believe, 900 kids. So I just want to fact check that for a second. There is language in the bill that says if you are meeting standards in terms of outcomes and you are effective with dollars with the state average, and you are geographically isolated or any of those kinds of combinations, and you have tried to work with neighboring districts to merge, then you can file for an exemption. So that's in there. So I apologize. That's not a yes or no question. I guess the answer is yes, that's already in the law. But the point of the law is also that maybe the expertise of your district would actually help a neighboring district. Wouldn't that be a good thing if a district next door that's also very small could work with your district, improve the quality of the outcomes, reduce costs, and give more opportunities for children? I think that's a very good thing. So I would hope that folks would be open-minded if they've got a district where it's working really well at the opportunity to help a neighboring district also do really well.
Do you think, though, the provisions of this law should be mandatory? I mean, it's what Act 46 is saying, you know, if you don't meet our provisions, we'll do it for you.
Well, let's remember this is a 4-year piece of legislation, and we're, I think, entering into year 3 coming up. And we did decide in the legislature, and it was across the board that we decided not to tinker with it until we really saw where the challenges were in the discussions, where the challenges were in terms of districts having a hard time making it work. And then we would come back to it and revisit it. And I'm quite certain that this coming year, we will be revisiting it. And I certainly hope to help make an education committee that is thoughtful and deliberative amongst the range of issues around school choice, around different systems that schools operate under, different geographic challenges, and find ways to come up with alternatives so that we can still find as many efficiencies through administrative savings while still preserving many of the characteristics that we value in our local schools and keeping our small schools open. So I think there's going to be a thoughtful and positive discussion about Act 46 in the upcoming session, and I look forward to that.
And do you think there'll be some changes made to Act 46 based on the experience so far?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a couple different changes. Certainly the union model, which is in Act 46, you know, the preferred model is district. But that doesn't mean everything's going to work out to be the preferred model. So the union model, but reducing the number of districts within the union, is still an option for many. But the way that was drafted also created some problems with respect to how to do that. So I think that should be addressed. I think there's also some issues around size of school boards and proportionality. I heard about that down in Athens, Rockingham, Westminster West, and that area of the state. So there's a number of different issues to address. I don't think they're insurmountable, and I think that's where a good deliberative process like we have will come up with good solutions.
Well, this is certainly a race we'll be watching in the coming weeks. David Zuckerman, the Democratic Progressive candidate for Lieutenant Governor, many thanks for being on the program today.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it, and I hope folks will go to Zuckerman4VT.com if they have any questions.
Coming up next, I'll talk with retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis about what might be the most important factor in the race for governor this year. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. In the past 8 presidential elections, there have been 4 times when voters chose a presidential candidate of one party and then voted for the gubernatorial candidate of a different party. The degree of ticket splitting this year will almost certainly determine who wins the race for governor in Vermont. It seems relatively certain that Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton will win Vermont's 3 electoral votes. The question is, how many of her supporters will vote for the Republican gubernatorial candidate, Phil Scott? With us now to look at this situation is retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis. Eric, great to have you on the program.
Good afternoon, Bob.
So, Eric, in many ways, does this issue greatly influence the outcome of the governor's race? I'm thinking if Republican Phil Scott can persuade a sizable number of Hillary Clinton's voters to support him, he could well be the next governor of Vermont. But if he can't, then Sue Minter will likely be the new governor?
I believe that's an accurate analysis. At this point, I would say that Hillary Clinton will get somewhere between 55% and 65% of the vote in Vermont. I think the question is not so much how much Donald Trump gets. I don't see him getting much more than the mid-30s percentage vote share. The question is how many voters who aren't voting for Trump choose not to vote for Hillary Clinton either and vote for a third-party candidate or write in somebody else's name. But in any case, from Phil Scott's point of view, if roughly 2/3 of the voters don't vote for the Republican presidential candidate, he needs somewhere between 25% and 33% of them to vote for the Republican gubernatorial candidate in order to win the governor's race.
And we do have some recent examples of ticket splitting. Maybe the most dramatic example was back in 2004 when Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry won Vermont with 59% of the vote. And the Republican gubernatorial candidate, the incumbent Jim Douglas, won the governor's race with 59% of the vote. That's pretty dramatic.
Yes, that's very dramatic ticket splitting, and it means that close to 40% of the people who voted for John Kerry for president voted for Jim Douglas for governor. The difference between that race and this year is Jim Douglas was the incumbent, and incumbent governors always tend to do well. I think a good comparison for this year's presidential and gubernatorial races is way back in 1984. That's the last time an open gubernatorial seat coincided with a presidential election. And what happened that year is that Ronald Reagan won the electoral vote in Vermont with 58% of the vote. He won nationally, of course. And Vermont was still a pretty Republican state presidentially at that time. But Madeline Cunin, the Democratic candidate for governor, won just over 50% of the vote and had a margin of close to 2% over her Republican rival, John Easton. So there what we saw was the Republican win the presidential and the Democratic win the gubernatorial in Vermont. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a similar outcome this year, just with the parties reversed, that Hillary Clinton wins the presidential comfortably and Phil Scott scrapes out a narrow win in the governor's race.
You mentioned that Phil Scott needs to get between a quarter and a third of the votes from people who voted for Hillary Clinton. Would it be fair to say that most of these people are individuals who consider themselves to be independent voters?
Yeah, I think that it's not so much the Democratic base. I mean, we don't have registration by party in this state, so any estimate of the bases has to be just that, an estimate. But what I've always said is that the Democratic base, the core Democratic vote, is about 35% of the electorate. So a Democratic candidate can't rely just on Democratic voters. She has to get the votes of independents, and a Republican candidate whose base is smaller, closer to 25%, certainly can't rely just on Republican votes. He needs independents as well. So the people who think of themselves as independents, many of whom also would call themselves centrists or moderates, those are the people who determine who will win this year's governor's race.
So, Eric, imagine you're on the Phil Scott campaign. How do you go about persuading Hillary Clinton supporters to vote for Phil Scott?
Well, there's two things I would do. The first is Scott would point to his record in the legislature and then as lieutenant governor and say he's someone who has worked with people on both sides of the aisle. And he's demonstrated the ability to work cooperatively and collaboratively with Democrats to get things done. And in that connection, he could also mention he's been endorsed by some Democrats like Senator Dick Massa from Colchester. The second thing I think the Scott campaign will do is emphasize that their prime concern in this election is jobs, the economy, and affordability. And they will say that although Vermont's economy certainly isn't a basket case, it's not collapsing, it might very well not have done as well as it could have over the last 6 years, that jobs are fewer than they could have been, that income gains are smaller than they could have been, and that it's time for a change. And if you look at previous elections when the governor's seat was open, the time for a change argument worked effectively for the out party. It worked for Peter Shumlin as the candidate of the out party in 2010. It worked for Jim Douglas as the candidate of the out party in 2002.
So let's flip over to the campaign of Democratic candidate Sue Minter. What would your approach be to make certain that as few of Hillary Clinton's supporters also vote for Phil Scott?
Well, the first thing I would do is not take the approach of tying Phil Scott to Donald Trump. I know there's some people in Vermont Democratic circles who think that's a good approach. I have my doubts about it because Scott was one of the first people to speak out against Trump. He made it clear roughly a year ago that he did not support Trump, would not vote for him in the Republican primary, would not vote for him or support him if he ended up as the Republican nominee. I think people who follow Vermont politics know that there's a lot of differences between Phil Scott and Donald Trump. I think a better tactic for the Democrats would be first to focus on specific issues where they would claim that Scott's positions are inconsistent with what Vermont needs. So they would talk about his reservations about raising the minimum wage or his reservations about a paid family leave or medical leave program. And those are things that may appeal to independents as well as to core Democrats. The other thing I think they would say is that there's a risk with switching parties right now. While things may not be great, anytime you make a change, there is a risk. Now, that argument has its problems, however, and I think it has to do with the person whose name is not on the ballot, which is Governor Shumlin. Some national polls out this week show that President Obama's approval rating is now around 55%. And I think that's one of the reasons why Hillary Clinton is doing better in national presidential polls, as well as all of Trump's problems and issues, that there's a general sense among lots of Americans that, especially in the last couple of years, Obama has done a reasonably good job and that continuing some of the lines of policy he's been pursuing wouldn't be all that bad. We're likely to see some polling about Shumlin here in Vermont before the election, and my guess is it'll show his approval rating is 10 to 15% below Obama's, somewhere in the 40 to 45% range. So a challenge for Sue Minter and the Vermont Democrats is there isn't this overwhelming sense of support for the incumbent governor, and when the incumbent governor has a somewhat checkered rating and voters have doubts about him, the candidate of the party who's trying to succeed that departing governor faces a challenge. And I think that's particularly the case for Sue Minter because although she's obviously not currently in the Shumlin administration, she was part of that administration, even though she worked on transportation issues, not the more controversial things like health care or the or energy policy. Still, I think trying to succeed a relatively unpopular governor of the same party is a big challenge.
You mentioned some of those issue differences between Minter and Scott. If you were on the Minter campaign, would you also bring up gun control as one of those differences?
Well, Minter is certainly talking about gun control. My view about the gun issue is that, and again, we see from polling that there's pretty strong support for universal background checks and some other limits on gun sales among Vermonters. But my view on this is that the voters who feel most intensely about guns on both sides of the issue are a relatively small proportion of the electorate. Every poll I've seen in Vermont over the last year or so indicates that jobs and the economy are at the top of the list of Vermonters' priorities, and then below that are a collection of other issues that include health care, that include education, and that include the environment, climate change, and so forth. And gun control tends to rate, and gun policy tends to rate pretty low on the list. So I'm not sure there's a large number of voters who are going to be motivated by an appeal just on the gun issue.
You know, the Minter campaign, Eric, says it does want to try to tie Phil Scott to Donald Trump, and they say the two candidates share much more than just a party affiliation. The Minter campaign says the two candidates share an economic vision that favors the wealthy and a philosophy that downplays the importance of dealing with climate change. If they expand it out to those issues, does that make sense for them to go down that road?
They could, although one of the problems with that is that it's hard to know what Donald Trump's economic policy is since it seems to change every week, if not every day. The climate change issue may actually be something where the Democrats could get some traction. I mean, Phil Scott does believe climate change is human-induced, but he's also more cautious about governmental action to respond to it than many Democrats are. And he says we need to consider the costs for consumers and businesses of some of the responses to climate change that have been proposed, as well as their benefits. But I think the environmental and climate change issues are ones that that the Democrats may be able to gain some traction with in the governor's race.
Eric, I noticed that for the past 56 years, Vermont voters have alternated between Republican and Democratic candidates for governor. It's really quite remarkable that two candidates of the same party have not been elected in succession. Is there something to this, or is this just an accident?
I think there's something to it, and I think it's what I referred to earlier as the time for a change phenomenon. I think it's a sense sort of that after one party has been in office, and recently, since Madeline Cunham was governor for the last 30 years, governors have remained in office somewhere between 3 and 5 terms. So it's been 6 to 10 years that one party's governor has been in office and then succeeded by a candidate from the other party. And I think after 6 to 10 years, voters come to feel, well, maybe it's time to give the other team a chance, so to speak. And we've seen this cyclical pattern. The legislature in more recent years has been much more resistant to change. It tends to be strongly Democratic. The only question is how large the Democratic majorities will be. But for the governor, the sense of a change and alternating between the parties seems to be a rather established part of Vermont political life for the last 30 years. And again, that's one of the things I think that is working to Phil Scott's advantage and is a challenge for Sue Minter in this election cycle.
Eric Davis, thanks very much for bringing the ticket-splitting issue to our attention, and many thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure, Bob.
That's it for today. Coming up on Monday, Vermont has the approval from the federal government to start moving towards an all-payer health care system. What does that mean? On the next Vermont edition, we'll talk about all-payer, how it works, and what it would mean for the state. And in 2 weeks, we begin our series of election debates. We want your questions for the candidates. Go to vpr.net to submit your question in writing, or better yet, record your question on your smartphone and send it to vermontedition@vpr.net. Our series of six debates for state and federal offices begins later this month. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.